Hello, I'm Joan Brown, one of several members of the IASB staff who are working on the IASB's project to update its conceptual framework. With me is Mary Tucker, an IASB board member. This webcast is one of a series that the IASB is doing to discuss various problems that we're seeking to address in this project. Today, we're going to be discussing a problem that arises from a lack of guidance on the definition of a liability, specifically on whether an entity has a liability if it has an obligation that may require a transfer of resources if further conditions are met, and the entity has the ability to avoid these conditions, at least in theory. This question has arisen in a range of contexts, and lack of guidance has caused problems in practice, both for the IASB in developing new standards and for the IFRS Interpretations Committee and others in interpreting existing standards. Before we start, slide 2 sets out a few housekeeping matters for you to bear in mind. There are 2 points I'd particularly like to draw to your attention. First, about questions. Later in this webcast, we'll have time to answer your questions. You can submit a question at any time during the webcast. Just type it into the text box on the screen and click submit. We've got another team member, Manuel Capsis, here, and he will pick up your questions as we go through. And secondly, especially when we are answering questions later, please remember that the views that Mary and I express are our own personal views. They're not necessarily shared by other members of the board or the staff of the IASB. And the official position of the IASB is explained in the discussion paper itself. Okay, so let's get started. Mary's going to start with a bit of context about the purpose of this project before explaining the problem that we're going to be discussing today.
Thanks, Joan. I'll start by explaining what we are hoping to achieve in the project as a whole. I'd like to emphasize that, first, we're not writing a completely new conceptual framework. We think that the existing framework generally works well. We don't intend to rip it up and start again. Instead, we identified specific areas where weaknesses in the existing framework are giving rise to problems when we are developing standards and problems with consistency in interpreting and applying existing standards. We're hoping to strengthen the framework in these areas by filling in gaps. We're at a relatively early stage in the process of amending the existing conceptual framework. So far, we've set out some preliminary views in a discussion paper and are asking for comments by January 14, 2014. Our preliminary views may change in light of the comments we receive, and even when we reach final decisions and agree the revised conceptual framework, the changes we make to the framework won't automatically change or override existing standards. Any decision to amend an IFRS as a consequence of changes to the framework would need to be a separate project involving the ISB's usual consultation processes. So, as I said, this project focuses on gaps in the conceptual framework that have led to problems in standard setting and in practice. We're doing a series of webcasts highlighting the main areas covered by the discussion paper, and we're talking about just one of those areas today. So today's problem is, as Joan said, is the one that arises from the definition of a liability, specifically whether an entity has a liability if it has an obligation that will require a transfer of resources if further conditions are met, and the entity has the ability, at least theoretically, to avoid those conditions. Now, before I dive in with slides, let me give a reminder. This is a specialized issue in terms of accounting for liabilities. What I mean by specialized issue is that for many, if not most liabilities, there is not conditionality or a question about whether the entity could avoid a transfer of resources. The issue of conditionality comes up in a small proportion of the cases involving liability recognition, but when it does come up, it can be very important. Therefore, we are trying to address the problem without creating unintended consequences for the straightforward liabilities for which conditionality is not an issue. But conditionality does come up in a number of different contexts, including employee benefits, leases, and levies. And in the absence of guidance in the conceptual framework, different IFRSs have taken different approaches. And slide 4 illustrates how they can differ. First, let's consider IAS 37, which deals with provisions, contingent liabilities, and contingent assets. IAS 37 includes within its scope levies, which are now addressed in IFRIC 21. Often, the amounts of levies are calculated by reference to the entity's past revenues or some other past activity measure, but the amounts are payable only if a further condition is met in the future, such as the entity still operating in a specified market on a future date. IAS 37 says that it is only those obligations, quote, existing independently of an entity's future actions that are recognized as provisions. So, for levies within the scope of IFRIC 21, no liability is recognized until all conditions are met. But other standards take a somewhat different approach. For example, IAS 34 addresses, among other things, contingent lease payments, additional payments that a lessee has to make only if its sales exceed an annual threshold. IAS 34 requires liabilities for these payments to be recognized as progress is made towards the threshold if the lessee expects to reach the threshold. IAS 34 explains this approach, saying that the entity has no realistic alternative but to make the payments. And then there is IFRS 2. IFRS 2 addresses liabilities for cash-settled share-based payments that will be made only if the entity meets performance-based vesting conditions. IFRS 2 requires entities to accrue the liability over the vesting period, even if providing all of the service is required before the employee gets any payment. The rationale is that the entity's liability arises from its receipt of those services. These differences in approaches can give rise to problems both for the ISB when we are developing new standards and for the Interpretations Committee and others in interpreting and applying existing standards. So what we hope to do is to develop a principle in the conceptual framework that could be applied to reach more consistency when IFRSs are developed in future. The discussion paper explores three different approaches, and Joan will explain them to you now.
Okay, thanks, Mary. Let's go back by starting with the definition of a liability. And as we discussed in an earlier webcast, the discussion paper is proposing to refine slightly the existing definition of a liability to that shown on slide 5. The suggested definition is very similar to the existing one. In many respects, the key ingredients wouldn't change. A liability would be a present obligation of the entity to transfer an economic resource as a result of past events. And the question we're really trying to consider today is what is meant by present obligation. The first explicit requirement that you can see in the definition is that the obligation must arise from past events. And the discussion paper suggests that an obligation can be viewed as having arisen from past events if the amount of the future transfer will be determined by reference to benefits received or activities conducted by the entity before the end of the reporting period. The activities conducted by the entity could include, for example, making sales or earning profits or even operating on a particular date. The important criterion is that the amount of the liability is determined by reference to that particular activity. However, this is where the problem arises. There are different views on whether the past event is sufficient on its own to create a present obligation if the resulting requirement to transfer an economic resource is also conditional on the entity's future actions. And there are three views considered in the discussion paper. The first view is that the past event is not sufficient. A present obligation must also be strictly unconditional. In other words, there is nothing the entity could do by itself to ensure that it avoids the transfer. This view reflects the approach taken in IAS 37, which you will remember from Mary's earlier slide, says that an obligation must exist independently of the entity's future actions. The second view is similar in that it also requires the obligation to be unconditional. But instead of requiring it to be strictly unconditional, view two requires it to be practically unconditional. And by this, we mean that although the entity might in theory be able to avoid its obligations, it doesn't have the practical ability to do so because it could only avoid the obligation by, say, ceasing to operate as a going concern or severely curtailing its operations or leaving specific markets. This view reflects a rationale similar to that underpinning the requirements for contingent lease payments in IAS 34, which are based on the entity having no realistic possibility of avoiding a payment. Now, applying view two, it's important to remember that the definition also includes the requirement for the obligation to have arisen from past events, because there are lots of future operating expenses that an entity might not have the practical ability to avoid. But because these future expenses haven't arisen from past events, they wouldn't be regarded as present obligations. The third view is different from the first two. The third view is that the past event alone is sufficient to create a present obligation. The entities received a resource or conducted an activity in exchange for which another party may be able to demand the transfer of resources. The obligation could either be unconditional or conditional on the entity's future actions. But either way, the entity no longer has complete discretion to avoid the transfer. And on taking any further specified actions, it will be required to transfer a resource because of the past receipt or activity, or perhaps to exchange resources on more onerous terms because of the past receipt or activity. In effect, the entity is recognizing in each period all of the costs expected to be payable in exchange for the benefits received in that period. This view is similar to that underpinning the requirements of IFRS 2, which sees the obligation to make share-based payments as arising when the employer receives the services in exchange for which it might make a future payment, even if that payment is conditional on further performance conditions. We've got a simple example to illustrate the different consequences of these three different views, and Mary will run through that now.
Okay. We picked one of the examples in the discussion paper to illustrate the three views. Now, just want to flag that the discussion paper includes six examples covering different types of transactions, and people sometimes ask us if we're now going to start including examples in the conceptual framework because we included them in the discussion paper, and the answer to that is no. We put examples in the discussion paper to show what the possible consequences of different views might be for, in this case, a range of transactions, but they're really there to support the discussion paper consultation process, not proposals for the final conceptual framework. So let's look at 5.7. And a summary of the fact pattern we'll be discussing today. This example involves a levy, which is charged to entities that operate trains on a national rail network. The levy is charged at the end of each calendar year. The levy is 1% of revenues earned in excess of $100 million a year. So it's only charged on an amount above that $100 million threshold. In this example, a train operator is preparing financial statements for its annual reporting year ending June 30th. So it has a different year than the levy assessment period. Its earned revenue of $60 million in the 6 months to 30th of June. It expects to have earned revenues of $120 million by the end of the calendar year, and hence to be charged a levy of $0.2 million for the calendar year. Of that, you could say that $0.1 million is attributable to revenue in the first 6 months of the calendar year. Alternatively, you could argue that all revenues below that threshold of $100 million are levy-free, and so the full amount of the levy, the $0.2, should be recognized as an expense of the revenues that cross the threshold in the second half of the calendar year. The question that we're trying to answer is whether having made some progress towards a threshold creates a present obligation to pay a levy. So now let's use that fact pattern to look at how the three approaches identified in the discussion paper would analyze this set of facts. We'll start with view one, which I believe we call the strictly unconditional approach. First, we have to ask whether there's been a past event, and we would conclude that, yes, there has been a past event. The rail operator has started to receive the benefits, in this case revenues, by reference to which the amount of the future levy will be determined. Then we have to consider whether there is a strictly unconditional obligation. And here we conclude no. The rail operator's obligation is conditional on its future actions, that is, generating more revenues in the second half of the year. Until revenue has actually exceeded the $100 million threshold, the operator could avoid a payment through its future actions. So applying view one, we conclude that it does not have a present obligation. Okay. Let's move from view one to view two. So we've already concluded when we looked at view one that, yes, there is a past event, and there's no change in that conclusion. So now we have to consider whether the operator's obligation is practically unconditional rather than strictly unconditional. Here we have to use judgment. Does the rail operator have the practical ability to avoid exceeding the $100 million threshold by the end of the calendar year? The answer will depend on facts and circumstances, but I think that in this case, it's quite likely that the rail operator would not have the practical ability to avoid exceeding the revenue threshold because it would have to significantly curtail its operations to do so. And in that case, I think we'd judge that the rail operator does indeed have a present obligation. And now finally, let's consider the consequences of view three. We've already concluded, once again, that yes, there has been a past event creates conditional obligation. As a result of the past revenues, the rail operator, if it exceeds the threshold, will have to pay a larger levy in future than it would have had to pay in the absence of the revenues for the first 6 months of the calendar year. And applying view three, this past event is sufficient to give rise to a present obligation. As a result, the rail operator accounts in the current period for all of the costs expected to be attributable to revenue from the first 6 months of the year. So you can see that applying this view, the uncertainty about the amount of the levy ultimately payable would not be relevant in deciding whether a liability exists. However, it could be relevant when considering whether the liability should be recognized, and if recognized, then how much should be recognized. Suppose, for example, that the facts were slightly different. The chance of the rail operator exceeding the threshold was judged to be low or even very low. The ISB could specify that in such cases, the liability should either not be recognized or should be measured at its most likely outcome of zero, with disclosure of other possible outcomes. And that brings me to a more general observation about the three views. Their purpose is purely to assist with decisions as to whether a liability exists. Any liabilities identified would not necessarily be recognized. Having identified whether a particular type of transaction gives rise to a liability or not, the ISB would then have to consider whether any liability satisfies the recognition criteria, and this would be done at a standards level. Now, to finish our presentation, I'm going to pass back to Joan, who will explain what the ISB members have concluded about each of these three views.
Thanks, Mary. Let's go back to the summary of the three views to remind us of the differences. As Mary said, the ISB has debated these three views, and it's tentatively rejected view one. And that's because it doesn't think that an entity should omit from its financial statements any liabilities that have arisen from past events and that the entity has no practical ability to avoid. However, the ISB hasn't at this stage expressed a preference for either of View 2 or View 3, and it's keen to hear more views from other people before doing so. I think people who support View 2 like the notion of a liability being something unavoidable, and they're concerned that View 3 might open the door to liabilities being identified in too many situations, though I'm not aware of any specific examples that people are worried about. I think that people who support View 3 like the notion that an entity would account in each period for all of the costs expected to be payable in exchange for past receipts or activities. And I think they're also concerned that View 2 could be difficult to apply in practice because it requires a judgment about whether an entity has the practical ability to take a particular course of action. The judgment might be quite clear-cut in some circumstances, but more subjective in others. For example, if the entity has the practical ability to lessen but not completely avoid a transfer, or if it has the ability but a significant economic disincentive to avoid a transfer. Even with extensive application guidance, there's a risk that different entities will reach different judgments and to some extent comparability will be lost. Mary, you're one of the ISB members. Do you want to add any personal thoughts on these three views?
Not surprisingly, I do have personal views on these, and I'd be happy to share them, in part because I feel like I have a lot of history with them and a lot of pain and suffering invested. It's actually my third incarnation of dealing with these issues, wrestling with them first in my incarnation as a regulator when the IASC was developing IS 37 back in the 1990s, and then responding to some exposure drafts for amendments of IS 37 five or six years ago on behalf of one of the major audit networks. And now I'm confronting them for the third time at a standard-setting level, and I have to say, pleased to be finally holding the pen or having one of the hands on the pen to address this issue. And the two things that I wanted to comment about from my personal perspective are probability and practical ability. First, regarding probability, the probability of something happening or not happening is important, but to me it's not the driver of our recognition approach. For example, future salaries of current workforces are highly probable when considering a going concern basis of preparation. But that high degree of probability does not make them current liabilities. Otherwise, on the basis of a going concern approach, we'd be recognizing and measuring the present value of all future operating expenses, at least in the most simplistic and extreme view of what going concern means for liability recognition. Therefore, we've got to find a way to draw a dividing line between present and future obligations in a way that puts future costs, even if highly probable, on the non-recognition side. The second is practical ability. As we've discussed the issues around liability recognition and the discussion paper questions, I found myself gravitating towards View 2. Maybe I'm just somebody who's happier in the middle than sitting at either extreme, but View 3 seems to me a little bit fuzzy and not as well defined as View 2, and I like the idea of practical ability being the focus of the consideration. But the challenge will be that to making View 2 work is getting a robust and operational description of what an entity's practical ability means, and how that interrelates with, among other things, going concern. And I'd be interested in hearing today or in comment letters in response to the discussion paper whether people think that the current description is specific enough to be a workable starting point for developing standards dealing with conditional liabilities. And with those two observations, I'll turn back to Joan.
Thanks, Mary. We've now reached question time, and I'd like to introduce Manuel Capsis here. As I said earlier, another member of the IASB staff working on the Conceptual Framework Project. He's been reading your questions as you've been submitting them during this webcast, and I think has picked out a few to ask Mary and me to answer now in the remaining time.
Thanks, Joan. Yes, we've got a few questions here, and if you haven't submitted any questions yet, I encourage you to do so now. The first question that I wanted to ask is about the implications for existing IFRSs. And the question is this. The example you've used is a levy, which is in the scope of IFRIC 21. IFRIC 21 isn't consistent with the ISB's preliminary views in the discussion paper. Does that mean that the ISB has plans to withdraw IFRIC 21?
I'll take that one on, Mrs. Mary. No, it does not mean that if we finalize the conceptual framework based on the preliminary view in the discussion paper, that IFRIC 21 would immediately be yanked or immediately be modified. Touched on this in the introductory remarks, the conceptual framework is meant to be the anchor and the starting point for our standard-setting activities after we finalize it. And it will not mean that we automatically prioritize review of all existing standards to eliminate all inconsistencies with the revised framework. We have an established process for individual projects and for assessing our overall agenda, and something like the question of should IFRIC 21 be revised would fall into that existing process.
Okay, we've got another question here, and this one has to do with the notion of constructive obligations that we have in a few of the standards, the existing standards. And the question is, isn't view two simply saying that an entity should recognize constructive obligations?
Right. I'll answer that one because it's one that is similar to a question that comes up quite frequently when we're talking about these three views. And the answer is no, not really, because constructive obligations are like conditional obligations in that if you apply a view two type reasoning, both can be justified as liabilities because the entity has no practical ability to avoid them, even if it has a theoretical ability to do so. But the reason that the entity has no practical ability to avoid the obligation is different for constructive obligations than it is for conditional obligations. A constructive obligation is an obligation, we've defined it to be an obligation that arises when an entity indicates, either by its past practices or some sort of published policy, that it will accept a responsibility to make a payment or do something for somebody else, even though there isn't a contractual, statutory, or other legal mechanism that would force it to do so. And as a result of that, it doesn't have the practical ability to avoid the obligation. So examples could be bonuses to employees in excess of those to which the employee is contractually entitled, or environmental rehabilitation activities that go beyond those required by the law of the land. Like legal obligations, constructive obligations could be subject to future conditions, but it's not those conditions that makes the obligation constructive. So, for example, the levy we considered in this webcast wasn't a constructive obligation. It was a conditional statutory obligation. We do have a bit of a discussion of constructive obligations in the conceptual framework discussion paper, starting around about paragraph 3.39 for anybody who'd be interested in reading about them.
We have a question that is on a similar theme to that, Joan. It's where does economic compulsion fit? Can it be considered in assessing practically unconditional?
Right. Well, that is a good question, and it illustrates the work that would be needed if we were to go down a sort of view two type route, because there would be a need for further guidance on the extent to which economic compulsion or any sorts of economic incentives could be drivers of practical ability or not. And as I said during the presentation, those who have concerns about view two, it's around assessing this sort of thing, like the extent to which economic compulsion. So I can't give a straight answer, I'm afraid. I think it would be something that would need a little bit more work.
And Joan, Mary, just to throw in my take on that, I'm kind of wondering, thinking about this as a standalone question, whether economic compulsion may be more almost an approach three than an approach two issue, although I can see that really an extreme form of economic compulsion, let's say a requirement to liquidate or something really life-threatening happens as a consequence of not doing X, whether X is buying back shares or paying a dividend, for example, whether that might start drifting into Category 2. My recollection is that we have at least brief acknowledgement of questions around economic compulsion in the discussion paper, and that's probably going to be a challenge for us to develop a bit more as we move forward to an ED.
That's true. And another thought occurred to me as you were saying that. You were talking about whether something fits in view two or view three. And certainly the feedback that we're getting or we have been getting so far from people is I think there's a general agreement with the board's preliminary view against and view one and rejecting view one in favor of something more like view two or view three. But there has been a feeling where people aren't quite sure where they sit between view two and view three and possibly what the differences would be certainly in practice between views two and three and where economic compulsion would fit in each one.
Okay, I think that's all the time we have for questions. Thanks to those of you who have submitted the questions, and I'm sorry that we haven't had time to answer all of them. We do have further information available on our website, and slide 10 lists some of the other examples in the discussion paper, some of the links that might be of most use to you in particular. You might like to look at some of the other examples in the discussion paper that illustrate the possible consequences of the three views for a range of different transactions. And as we said earlier, today's webcast is one of a series in which we examine a range of topics being covered in the conceptual framework discussion paper. Slide 11 lists a number of topics that were covered by other webcasts. You'll find recordings of the previous webcasts and information about future webcasts by following links from the Conceptual Framework Project page. And thank you for listening. Goodbye.